Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It's been a brutal couple of weeks. I apologize that I missed last week. My health hasn't been very good. The stress of the last 4 or 5 years is taking its toll. To maintain this research agenda, the articles and books that I'm putting out, I have 3 more books in the works. I'm working on 8 or 9 articles at any given time. Doesn't include the Barnes Review and American Free Press and stuff like that. And there's translations. And then over the course of a week, I have about 50 people coming to me for advice. Why they pick me is a bit of a mystery. These are Orthodox people who trust me. And I give excellent advice. I'm actually very talented. I just never take any of it myself. So I've been ill, and really stress is the cause. And there's many, many things that I'm not going to burden you with. But as always, I ask you to support my work. We're living in an age where fewer and fewer people are dealing with original content. Fewer and fewer people even know how to build an argument and what that entails. Fewer and fewer people are able to read the more difficult works of our tradition, whether it be Aristotle or Kant or Hegel, or even the medieval logicians. And in an academic environment like today, there's really no reason to. What is the point of knowledge if things like gender and ideology are the only things you're going to be hired and protected for? Which actually is the topic for today. My supporters have become a second family to me. I don't have a first family anymore. So you guys mean a lot more to me than just people who give me money. You keep me going in general. And it means the world to me that any of you bother to donate to this. Many years ago, when I was first asked to do it by the guys at Voice of Reason, I turned them down, saying that my academic style would never work on radio. I don't have guests. I do, I talk to you the exact same way that I talk to students in the classroom. I don't use PowerPoints or blackboards, no bells, no whistles. I'm the only prop you guys need, as I used to say. But how is that going to translate to radio or podcasts or this kind of audio format? And they finally sent me the equipment, figuring that I'd be too lazy to send it back, but then I'd feel guilty, so I couldn't keep it, so I'd just have to do it. I was very appreciative of them, and of course, I did it. And I became the number one draw on the Voice of Reason, then I became the number one draw on the Daily Stormer. I don't know why that is, but it gives me a great amount of hope. They're like university lectures, just without the stupidity and the brainwashing. But my website is rusjournal.org. And there you could send money so I can continue this research and battle the various demons, both internally and externally, that I have to deal with. There's been many campaigns to shut me down. There's been many campaigns to simply plagiarize me out of existence. And it's getting worse and worse. Real academic and scholarly ability is disappearing. So stealing things and just mouthing words and using, you know, academic buzzwords and slogans. This is now the same thing as actually having academic ability. And we're going to talk about this because we're going to talk about Leo Strauss. I've done a bunch of shows now where I take people to task for dealing with a philosopher or an idea way over their head. I did it with the dialectic of Hegel. I've done it in other places where people use terms and drop names. They have no idea what they're talking about. And my target today is Shadia Drury. Female, of course. Attractive, obviously. Pictures of her everywhere. Who wrote a book on Leo Strauss. Actually wrote several. Now, there's plenty of people out there that I disagree with. There's a lot of people out there that I agree or disagree with. There's plenty of people out there whose honesty and ability I question. There's some people I respect and people I don't respect. But it's very rare that I find a work from a major university press that demonstrates, an entire book, that demonstrates absolutely no functional knowledge of the subject matter. And I'm finding that this is becoming a more and more common phenomenon. I've dealt with it on this show before. The abuse of Plato, the abuse of Nietzsche, the abuse of Hegel, the abuse of Hobbes. I mean, you know, getting involved with things, especially the abuse of Dugin, Ivan Ilyin, people like this, you know, whether it be leftists who are trying to attack us or well-intentioned right-wing amateurs who are trying to pad their credibility. They take guys who are very, very complicated and very difficult and really require many years of learning and try to reduce it to a couple of slogans that they, of course, use for some ideological end. And they sound like morons. The problem is not a whole lot of people know that they sound like morons. Johnson's Law says that whenever you have a obscure subject, the writer in question, the establishment writer, or journalist, or academic, will be prone to take more liberties because there's fewer and fewer people over time that really can say anything bad about. Hegel is an obvious one. You could say anything, and very few people have actually read the guy. Leo Strauss is, for the most part, a good guy, as far as he goes, which, by the way, is not very far, since he never leaves the realm of very, very high abstraction. To be able to read Strauss, you have to know Plato and Aristotle backwards and forward. You have to know your ancient history. You have to know the history of philosophy. You have to know the technical words and terms and arguments. And you have to know them with a great degree of fluidity. You have to go back and forth with them. You know, like we're talking about anything else. That ability is rare. Johnson's Law will say that a scholar who wants to make a name for herself can attack an abstract or obscure, vaguely conservative writer and say pretty much anything because very few people can read and read that kind of thing and say anything different. But Shadia Drury hasn't read any of the sources. She's written many books on major presses, I think university presses, without having read the person that she's writing about. It's not a matter of opinion. Strauss on many of these issues is very, very clear. Sometimes he's not. But what he most certainly is very abstract, very abstruse, and very difficult. I first read him at the University of Hartford as an undergraduate. I think it was 1992, and I gave up. I couldn't do it. I had no idea what this guy was talking about. Often what happens is that a scholar will use words that are common as technical terms, but they're very different from how those words are used in common speech. Words like natural or right, you know, these are very common in Strauss. And Strauss operates on such a high level of abstraction. And he really only makes in his career a few very salient, very powerful points, and he makes them very well. Strauss was a Jewish emigre to the United States, an opponent of Heidegger, but certainly he respected Heidegger very much, who came to the New School under the Rockefellers, and then, of course, University of Chicago. So he certainly had Rockefeller funding. But over time, he began to oppose the foundations on which the New World Order was going to be created. That earned the ire of a lot of leftists, also taking Rockefeller grants, that wanted to tear him down. Now, here's the concept. It's said over and over again that Leo Strauss is the godfather of neoconservatism. Nothing can be further from the truth. No one who has read and understood a few pages of Strauss could ever make that claim. Neoconservatives have hijacked the term conservatives. There is nothing right-wing about anything they say. They are leftists. They are descended from Shachtman and Trotsky before him. And they hated Stalin, Soviet Union, convinced that it was an anti-Semitic empire, to the extent that they would join anybody. That fighting the Soviet Union was the greatest possible crusade. And in America, of course, that was the Republicans and the you know, militarist conservatives. But these guys are leftists in every other way. The very opposite of this can be found in Leo Strauss. Because so few people can read him, no one knows. What's really bothering me here, and what really has me very upset, is this Shadia Drury. He's a tenured professor, chairman, at a Canadian university, and teaching students, and is putting out stuff so bad that, well, there's a few things going on here. It's possible she simply has never heard the word no before, realizes that she is a woman, she's from Egypt, she could do what she pleases, no one will ever say no to her, and you know, she could just write down whatever scurrilous stuff she wants. And which is exactly what's happening. It could be that she is trying very, very hard, just can't do it. And so sticks only with a few very polemical things that she understands. It's also possible that she's going by secondary sources, which are often just as difficult as the primary source. But there's no question that she's never read Leo Strauss. Or if she has, she's understood only small parts, parts that are easier to grasp. Let me first summarize what Leo Strauss is about. His name is dropped all the time without the slightest understanding. See, because we don't have an intellectual class, we have a lot of phony PhDs, and you know who I'm talking about. You have a lot of people who are well-meaning and try very, very hard to master this stuff. You have people who aren't well-meaning and just want to sound like a scholar. We don't have an academic institution. We have no institutions at all on the nationalist right anywhere. So how can we have an intellectual class? I mean, Willis Carto and Liberty Lobby came the closest. He was able to hire me and support my research. That's what these guys do. But we have no one who's capable of that now. And if it were to happen, as would happen with Willis Carto, the right wing would just destroy it. There'd be envy, there'd be hatred. The regime doesn't send agents to infiltrate our tiny little groups. They know that we will destroy each other. Why would they spend all this money? Now, even with a violent group, you know, something, they may be worried. But our tiny little groups are not penetrated by agents. There's no way that they would spend the money, they would spend all that time, risk getting caught, when they know that the tiniest little bit of success will lead to the piranhas, our own people, coming and destroying it. It's happened too many times. And if that fails, they just send a hot girl in, acting like she's red-pilled, and they will kill each other, trying to get her attention. And they know that's all they have to do. Leo Strauss's work centers on the concept of both natural law and natural right. These things are similar but not identical. Strauss is a defender of classical natural right. Now, when I say the word right, I'm referring to a state of affairs, justice, actions that we might commit that have great moral and civic importance. The noble class has to exist in the sense that any expert class exists in any field. What people fail to understand is that, of course, political science and political theory and foreign policy and public policy, all this stuff is a specialized field that takes many years to master. There are even in the most obscure area, there are mountains and mountains that take years to read through, to even begin to penetrate. Yeah, a lot of it is nonsense, but you still have to know why it's nonsense. The noble life is good in and of itself. It is based on reason, therefore it's based on freedom. If something is rational, it can't have any non-rational entities competing for its attention. You can't be, you know, no self-interest or oh, she's pretty, I can't say anything to her, or he has power over me, I can't say anything to him. Those are heteronomous elements. Those aren't rational, and they destroy reason. And very few people are able to be totally free of them. The noble life is one where you have the property you need to function without having to worry about any kind of external pressures. And therefore, you can concentrate on the truth. This is your intellectual ruling class. The West hasn't had an intellectual ruling class in many, many years. The New World Order has them in universities. Increasingly, not just corrupt and self-seeking, but they're not even interesting about it anymore. They're just not competent in the sources. But man is aware of the fact that he's rational, that his own existence isn't grounded in and of itself, but also that he has freedom of action. He can choose among competing alternatives in any important decision. He knows also that because of this, there are good decisions and bad decisions. Not everything is allowed. So to the extent that man is aware of reason and freedom, he's also aware of restraint. Therefore, restraint and freedom are equally primordial. No one denies at any point in history that the best men should rule. Just like the best men should be doctors and the best men, people who have the ability, people who are free from outside sources. Freedom is extreme, if not impossible, in most of America. The ruling class we have is the private profit-seeking class. They don't even pretend to be anything differently, so they hire politicians that use these slogans talking about universal, you know, human rights and things like that. So it appears that there's some kind of political debate. And that goes back to the Medici family in Italy. We've talked about this before. The problem is that most people don't know that they don't know. The wise, of course, should be in charge. Well, Strauss offers no, and neither is really anybody else. I mean, Plato creates the concept of the guardians, that they can have no property, they can have no family, because this would make them unfree. Families are leverage. Families are nepotism. Anything that would impinge on free thought, making it unfree, Plato tries to remove. And Nietzsche does the same thing as far as his supermen and where they, you know, how they come to be. They are always alone and isolated and living in a cave somewhere and rejected. So you have to convince people, A, that they don't know, which is very hard to do, and B, that they're people who do know. And some people are reasonable. They understand this. But generally speaking, the wise, you know, somebody can't impose themselves on people. That's never possible. And even if they could, they often are corrupted very quickly. So the concept in Aristotle of the mixed system comes into existence. There has to be a level of consent. Now, Drury tries to pretend that this has something to do with the corrupted capitalist ruling class in America. Of course, Strauss means the exact opposite, and he's very clear about this. There is an aristocrat, which is a good thing. This is a wise man, and an oligarch who only cares about himself. Drury doesn't know the difference and believes that any ruling class, which anything that exists has to have, anything social that exists has to have, can't be aristocratic without being oligarchic. Justice is defined in the classic world as giving to each man what is due, what he's earned, what he deserves. But understand what that means. He uses the example of a big guy who owns a small coat and a small guy who owns a big coat. Well, they're both owners of those coats. They may even be attached to those coats for some weird reason. But it doesn't make any sense. The small man needs a small one, and the big one needs a big one. A wise person will simply take it and give it to the other one and say, hey, see, this is better. And he doesn't care about your free will or your private property. The common good, giving to each what he's due, allows no other absolutes. Procedural justice, which is so important to modernity and to liberals, is meaningless without the content. So the mixed system is necessary so that people can realize, people can work with the aristocracy. The U.S. Constitution was made this way. The Senate was meant to be the aristocratic branch. The House, the popular branch. The aristocratic life is a social institution. There has to be methods by which we can nurture these kind of people. That's really hard to do. You know, people of great ability, of great creativity, come from all over the place. They often come from great adversity. He notes that sometimes the left will pretend to read these guys and say, well, these men were of the patrician class, and therefore they're supporting their own class interests, which is a very common thing. The, you know, grad students will say this to please their professors. And it doesn't make any sense. Of course, somehow it doesn't apply to them. What's their interest in saying this? University professors are very well paid. And if they don't spout liberalism, they get fired. That's not my opinion. That's how it is, because it happened to me many times. Deconstruction, these kind of class analysis, they never turn it back on themselves. They, of course, are fully autonomous beings. Foucault has never been deconstructed. They'd be outraged if that would ever happen. Class analysis has never been turned on the left. It could then be a lot of Rockefeller family grants that would suddenly pop up. But of course, any man of ability is able to rise above his class. Any man of ability can rise. If you're incapable of rising above your specific interest, then you have no ability at all. You're more like these people. The modern alienated university professor who can't see that he's the problem. That he's the one who's biased. He's the one who's constrained. Not the far superior men who they study or claim to study. In any society, you have the wise men, wise in terms of academic truth as well as experience, the best men, and you have the common people. Now, the common people might be very good shoemakers, they may be very good policemen, but they don't know anything about righteousness, except in a very specific way. They know about their righteousness as a policeman or as a teacher. They're the ones who often can't go beyond their specific class to understand something. Classic natural right asks a simple question. What is it that makes all of these different people, a good cop, a good construction worker, a good accountant, a good father. What do they all have in common? We use the word good for all of them. So that means good has to be a separate concept greater than all these things. Well, what would it be? What makes them all good? And Aristotle comes to the conclusion that at any time, you know, the ideal system of a wise kingship or a small wise aristocracy can't be trusted. Now, there's one thing that Strauss brings up that's easier to understand, and that is that even the best societies, when they're faced with a ferocious enemy, can't be just all the time. I've said this many times relative to the police dealing with drug dealers and gangs. To the extent that these men, that the police are constrained by law and procedure, they will never win. If there's a war, then every enemy soldier can't be given a lawyer and an army of ACLU people agitating for him. On the invasion of Iwo Jima, the left wasn't demanding that every Japanese soldier be given due process before he's shot. That's exactly the case with drug dealers and these people, even though it's called a war. But of course, it can't be won. To be won, you have to do what the Taliban did and simply torch these poppy fields and put a gun to the farmer's head saying, if you do this again, your brain could be all over that field. There's nothing wrong with doing that. God knows how many lives it saved. And of course, the Taliban won, and they reduced opium production to zero during the reign of their caliph. And of course, that changed as soon as the Americans invaded, put a gun to their head to do the opposite. It's not something that people are comfortable with, but it has to be done. Even the most just of states have to take extreme action when they're faced with a violent enemy. And somehow people grab onto that concept and say, oh, that he's talking about, you know, the U.S. Violating all these laws, invading all these countries. Well, he's not referring to that at all. He never talks about foreign policy. In fact, he never talks about public policy. So, true goodness and absolute goodness does have to adapt itself to these situations. Righteousness can never be weakness. But this has nothing to do with American foreign policy, which has nothing to do with the common good, which has nothing to do with reason or freedom. And it has to do with either the interests of Israel, on the one hand, which Leo Strauss used to support, by the way, or the interests of the capitalist class, on the other. Either way, it's the exact opposite of what he's talking about here. Strauss is not someone who I follow. I've read everything he's written in the major works, and we have a lot of disagreements, but the basic core of his argument is excellent, and I cite it all the time. But in no way can that exception, which everyone admits, be taken as any kind of endorsement of American foreign policy. The claim is that people like Kristol and Podhoretz and Wolfowitz were students of Strauss. Well, they weren't. I think Bill Kristol took a class from Strauss. But most of these guys, well, they do have an academic education, are an academics, which is very odd. They don't talk like academics, which is very odd. But they've had no connection with Strauss. There's something, I'm noticing this, especially in the Ivy Leagues. You have guys who are given PhDs from these institutions who never utter another academic word ever again. Like Bill Bennett, Bill Kristol. You know, I could tell an academically trained person in 5 minutes of talking to them. There's a certain way that we carry ourselves. There's because of everything that the methods that we've learned and the extremely high levels of abstraction that we've been forced to deal with, our personality changes. The way we talk changes. You could tell. But these guys who have a PhD from Harvard talk like just anybody. They never make reference to academic subjects, except in the most assumed manner. Alan Dershowitz was installed by somebody at a very young age, like 24, as a law professor with no experience teaching or doing anything for that matter, with tenure. Now, of course, no one questions that. But because the Ivy Leagues generate regime intellectuals, you can't trust anything they do. So Bill Kristol has a PhD in government from Harvard, but he's not an academic. Well, that can't be. He couldn't have done normal academic work and just be an activist who never, ever, ever writes or talks in an academic way. So it can't be true. I did an article some time ago on Amy Bishop, the Harvard-educated biologist, who's both female and Jewish, although unattractive, who threatened her way through her PhD with doing no work. Got away with it. Long story. Got a job at University of Alabama and taught there for 6 years, not knowing the first thing about her field. 6 years. No one seemed to know it. The students hated her. She just read out of the textbook. Turns out she sent a bomb. Turns out to be a fake bomb to a guy named Rosenberg or Rosen something, Jewish chairman of the bio department there at Harvard. When she was denied tenure because she didn't publish anything, she shot up the school, killed two professors on the tenure committee and wounded two others. That's been swept under the rug. Very few people know who Amy Bishop is. It's not considered a tragedy because she's considered a genius. The New York Times even said that she had, you know, many scholarly publications, she had zero. So the Ivy Leagues do create fakes. People who they know will serve their interests, serve elite interests in one capacity or another, and the reward is that they get, you know, this doctoral degree to give them authority. Well, Bill Kristol and Bill Bennett and these other people, they never, ever talk and speak or write like academics for the rest of their lives, and I don't understand it, except for that. You know, the Dershowitz thing, I couldn't believe it. He was hired at a very young age, with tenure, never taught before, with tenure. Usually you have to wait 6 years. But, of course, the first thing he did, he doesn't actually teach. He gets millions of dollars a year. He doesn't actually do anything. He's an activist for the left and for Israel. But being a law professor at Harvard, well, he has that authority. How many people are able to question him at that level? I've been telling you people for a long time, Ivy League education is worthless. A graduate education there, at least in my field, has nothing to do with actually learning anything. You're there to help these people put out papers and assist them, and that's really what the education comes down to. And your dissertation is based on whether or not you're a female, how good looking you are, how much money you have, or if you're simply being pushed through like Amy Bishop was. I don't even know if she did a dissertation, but they just said she did. But one of the things her students said was that she didn't talk like she had any authority at all. Get a PhD in something legitimately and work your butt off like I did, under hostile circumstances like I did. You know your field. You know the ins and outs of it. You know every method. You know every approach. There's nothing anyone could spring on you. And your attitude and the way you speak reflects that. When that's not the case, then it's time to be suspicious. Good-looking women get what they want, including academic degrees. I've seen it happen. And I think it's the case with Shadia Drury. It's the case with Bill Kristol and Bill Bennett. But the one thing I know for a fact, the one thing I know they can't do, is read Leo Strauss. Strauss is an anti-modernist. He's an anti-modernist in the sense that, and I agree with him here, Machiavelli and Hobbes are the break between the ancient and the modern. The human ideal of what a man is, the absolute truth, the absolute purpose of human life is thrown out the window, and power becomes the only concern. Hobbes tries to create something where he has, you know, absolute rules that have nothing to do with ethics. They're simply not ethical. Self-preservation is, is uninteresting. It can't be the basis for anything. And of course, for Hobbes, human beings are not driven by reason. Reason is only rationalization. They're driven by their passions. Machiavelli sliced the ancient and the modern because he explained to the world, regardless of what its intentions were, it doesn't matter. This is how power actually is in northern Italy in the Renaissance. And he, of course, was absolutely right. That's how power is in all corrupt societies. The Renaissance in Italy was created and financed by the Medicis, like the left in Europe is created and financed by Soros. It has no existence apart from the Medici clan. And Strauss understands that. Machiavelli in Italy, Hobbes in England, roughly the same period of time. They're worried about legitimacy, not truth. And by legitimacy, it's how somebody being ruled by his passions and drives for power, can convince everybody else that he belongs there. Now, Drury will actually say, and Strauss, of course, heaps contempt on Machiavelli, saying that he simply destroyed any moral foundation for politics at all. He wrote an entire book on it, many articles on it, and yet Drury says he was Machiavellian in his ideology. Apparently, she missed that he wrote a whole book on the subject, and many articles, and many lectures. Now, if that's not proof that she didn't read a word of this man, then nothing will convince you. He actually says that Strauss argues that Machiavelli is the proper way to conduct policy. And yet he has books and articles condemning exactly that. The Enlightenment in terms of political ideology is based on the state of nature. When I was a kid and I came across, this is the very first concept I ever came across after reading The Gorgias in Plato's Republic. My very first political theory class was a modern one, and it started with Thomas Hobbes. Thomas Hobbes is the very first political theorist I ever read and heard about in depth. So I'll never forget it. That was a foundation for everything else. And of course, everyone recoils from it without realizing that the Enlightenment is based on his ideology. Purposeless motion, no natural end, no universal truths, except for Hobbes's. The state and law are never natural. They're solely the invention of frightened people. There are no families. People spring up like mushrooms, as he said. And human beings are isolated, just like atoms bouncing around matter. Somehow, though, state of nature is a concept of a revolution. State of nature is when a human being, prior to law, custom, language, anything, what would an adult human being be like without any of that? What would he be like just in and of himself, without any influences from religion or the state or anything else? Well, you could speculate. And anyone who talks about the state of nature theory has their own view, which of course conveniently fits their agenda. No one knows because those people left no records because there's no language. And of course, such a state never existed. Like Descartes had his cogito to remove everything except the one thing that he can't deny. The state of nature is just a social version of that. Remove everything in social life except the isolated human being. How would he act? An isolated human being is impossible. So it's a stupid question. But it shows exactly how far these guys are willing to go to create their revolution. But at some point, humanity has to progress from this. Strauss remarks that the natural man is something horrible. Whether he's brutish or ignorant or unrestrained or self-interested, as Locke would say, it's a bad thing. And it's inevitable that we leave the state of nature and actually create civilization. In other words, the natural order is not only has no content and is really nothing and dead, but it's bad. In other words, truth is precisely in breaking with nature. The great state of nature theorists, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, I include in there Adam Smith, and really Descartes in terms of epistemology. Rousseau spent a lot of time trying to figure out where reason comes from, because the natural man doesn't possess it. He lives in instinct like an animal. And he speculates, with no evidence, of course, but he speculates and says, because human beings are self-seeking and they seek pleasure, and therefore avoid pain, constantly seeking pleasure, seeking outlets for different drives and passions, over time, over different circumstances, in different environments, lead to your will and your drives developing something more abstract, a mechanism by which, and it's literally a mechanism, by which their utility can be served. Somehow there, civilization is conceived. The problem with all of this is that they all hold, because of the nature of the state of nature, that the state, law, culture, civilization is purely the creation of human beings acting in some kind of concert. In other words, it's not a natural development. Human beings are not social. Well, they say so because they actually invent the human being that's not social. That's not exactly an argument, but that's how it goes. For all of these guys, and really for modernity in general with no exceptions, modern thinking rejects the idea that anything is natural, including the human will. The state is not natural. They're the creations of men. Of course, we mean the creation of a small elite of men. Now, whether or not you even can speak of this break from the state of nature to civilization, it's nonsensical, of course. But it's a thought experiment. A thought experiment that revolutionized the entire Western world. Therefore, goodness, ethics, and right are quite relative. For all of these people, because the foundation of law and the state are exclusively the creation of consensus among people who require it, there's no truth involved there. There's only legitimacy. In other words, procedural justice takes the place of actual justice. Procedural justice is the idea that if we provide an objective jury trial for someone committed a crime, we'll get to the truth. If we have free elections and everyone is allowed to vote, we'll get the best person. If we put out a number of products for sale, and everyone goes and buys one or two of them, and they become the dominant brand, that must be the best brand. Or the brand that should be dominant. That's the assumption. Notice it has nothing to do with the actual content of these things, the product or the politician or anything else, the law, the verdict. That's not the issue. It's the procedure. If everyone wants to start buying crack instead of feeding their kids, well, that's what the market is going to respond to. If everyone votes for a moron, or doesn't vote at all, it doesn't matter, because the procedure was there. The only thing that the liberal state can offer is the procedure. Now, that's not true anymore, of course. That was all a lie. They do have absolutes. Things like the Holocaust, which is actually stated to be the absolute of modern time. The state, consumption, these are all absolutes in the modern state. But they don't really mean it. They'd like people to believe it. But you notice how this completely cancels the ancient and medieval understanding of justice. There is no natural law when you posit the state of nature crap. Strauss argues that, and again, I agree with him in this too, that this leads to a general despair and relativism. The only reason you follow a law is because you get in trouble if you don't, or you allegedly voted for. An attempt to find some kind of better foundation, historicism was developed. And there's echoes of that in Rousseau, but it gets more developed in the 19th century. Somehow, human beings don't have a natural purpose. States don't. Laws don't. But history does. And the beginning of the 19th century was that time that the universe enlightened certain philosophers that claimed to understand the purpose of history. That now becomes the absolute. And again, that collapses just like everything else. Empiricism collapses because it can't justify itself. Even reason itself. Why be rational? You can't give me a rational reason for it because it presumes itself. So it's circular. Same thing here. Why am I going to listen to somebody who says that everything's historically conditioned? How do you know that many years from now, what we're saying right now will be considered nonsense? Or that historicism turns out to be false? And how come historicism, the idea that there's this meaning in history, the march of history has a purpose, progress, etc., why is that not subject to the historicist criticism? Why is that the absolute? Where does that come from? What grounds that, other than your assumptions? Historicism, you know, Hegel's view is not nearly like, you know, is what developed later with the postmodernists, but the concept is, we're talking about historical relativism here. Hegel is not a relativist. But I shouldn't pay attention to something that is purely conventional, because it really has no force other than everyone agrees. Otherwise, it's nothing. Same for historical epochs and ideas. Historicism might turn out to be just a weird pimple in 19th century history that has really no great foundation. Usually what these guys do, and the one thing that irritates me and Hegel and others, they'll take an entire civilization and reduce it to a couple of paragraphs. So the East is more mystical, the West is more logical. Wild, sweeping generalizations that no specialist could ever possibly agree with. So it turns out really to be based on very, very little. It turns out to be based on nothing. Social science is supposed to be value-free. But then why do social science? There's got to be some ethical end, or why would I do it at all? Facts by themselves are absolutely meaningless. It's how they're organized. See, every act of reason presupposes a context. It presupposes a civic, a linguistic, methodological foundation that everyone agrees on. Without it, there can be no communication. What moderns tried to do is remove this context and try to take man as man. But they can't even conceive of the whole. They don't believe in the whole. So what are they referring to? Reason is not self-justifying. Social science is not self-justifying. There's no reason to be rational. In the beginning, we said the classical theorists, Aristotle, Plato, the noble life is good in and of itself because that's what man is. Man is defined by his reason and his freedom. So even if leading the noble life means that you're miserable, you're still doing the right thing because that's the purpose of your life. Well, thanks to Machiavelli and Hobbes, there is no purpose to human life. Power and power alone, and figuring out ways to legitimize it, that's the only reason for function. And that's not even a reason. There's been many ways, like historicism, to try to ground it somewhere. And people like Drury actually are, having never read The Man, impose, you know, these liberal conclusions onto a man who's attacking them. I mean, that's how bad it is. It's really hard to argue with someone who doesn't offer any coherent arguments. You take any argument for empiricism. This is one of Strauss's huge arguments. the assumptions here, and this is supposed to be an assumptionless science. Well, the assumptions, first of all, is that your senses are correct, that your logical design actually matches up with the world out there, not just an invention that you impose on it. It implies that there is a reason for doing this, and it has to be an ethical reason, which they don't accept, so they're in a state of cognitive dissonance over that, and that there's some good to be taken from it. None of that is empirically verifiable. The statement that a professor of mine made a long time ago, everything is science, is ridiculous because no science could justify that. To say that every historical epoch, you know, historicism is true, historical relativism is true, is a meaningless concept. Because how come historicism isn't as relative as everything else? Deconstruction is the same way. If you could do a genealogy of Socratic ethics, you could do the same thing on Foucault. How come they aren't subject to the same analysis? To the Marxist who says everything is based on class, how did you escape that? How did you upper-class university professor spouting Marxism rise above your class status and could see the whole universe understood Marx? But Hegel couldn't do that, and Kant couldn't do that, and Burke couldn't do that. You could, though. I tell you, you want to get a professor to hate you in grad school, turn their methods on themselves. I did it all the time. I mentioned Foucault only because that was the main guy I did it with. Professors have no sense of humor. They're not used to hearing the word no. At least this guy was male, so he had some rational approach to it. Foucault never turned his ideology on himself. But the arrogant thing is that these guys believe that they are not subject to the same constraints as everyone else in the world is. Someone who talks about relativism somehow has overcome relativism and has absolutes. Someone who says that empirical evidence is the only way we come to knowledge has made an absolute statement that's not empirically verifiable. Somehow he's exempted himself from his own ideology. Well, the classical writers were patricians, Athens or Sparta, whatever it is, and they couldn't see beyond that. But you, university professor, you can see beyond that. You can rise above your class status. But the reason that they continue in their error is that to say, to admit their mistake, is monstrous. If they say that there are absolute standards, that means they never change. If they never change, they're not material things. That means they're spiritual things. If they're spiritual things that are absolute and eternal, then they have to be created by something. That's at least absolute and eternal. What can that possibly be? So the reason why they refuse to understand the nature of their error is because the alternative is God and Christianity. And I've heard numerous Darwinists say that that simply is out of the question. True or false, it doesn't matter. It doesn't fit. You hear a lot of right-wingers talk about the survival of the fittest. Well, National Socialism has been defeated in every way possible. So that means their right to rule over us, right? No. Oh, wait a minute. So what are you appealing to? Has to be something outside of your system. Communist Party, the Soviet Union can kill millions of people because their ideology says that a human being is nothing more than a lump of matter, came into existence by accident, who has absolutely no purpose in the world, that the regime doesn't create itself. No soul, no different than anything around it except that it could feel pain. So what difference does it make if it's killed? What great moral sin is being committed if lots of them are killed for something else? There's no good reason. the existence of the soul is the only thing that makes a human being a human being. Killing that is another matter. But killing a hunk of matter is meaningless. It doesn't make any difference. This is how they justify it. Progress, which of course, you know, is where Darwin came from. Darwin came from the rule of British capital and the British colonial empire. It was music to the ears of these elites. It had to be accepted. It could only have come into existence in that era. Seems to have no understanding here in the Darwinian system that laws of evolution can't evolve. If a human being is nothing more than a lump of matter, he can't contain evolutionary laws within himself. That would imply some kind of spiritual essence. Because the laws of evolution, of course, can't be material. Or else they would come to be and pass away and decay and be destroyed like everything else. The laws of evolution don't evolve. They must be spiritual things. Are the laws of matter identical with matter? Or are they separate from matter? None of these things can exist on the physical plane. They exist because self-interest drives them. Strauss's whole argument is that modernity is based on foundations for thought that are self-interested, that are irrational, that are driven by a pathology to get away from the common good, to justify oligarchy, to reject God at any level, and to reject the spiritual world, reducing it to nothing. Positivism says that the only question that can be answered is a scientific one. But that's circular reasoning. Modern ideologies are very, very weak and can be overthrown really with just a little bit of thinking. But then why were these errors allowed to go on for so long? How could Darwin have ever survived the discovery of DNA? It's laughable at this point. No way could that have evolved. Even a simple cell has more information and linguistics within it, if we still haven't fully understood it. But somehow that, you know, all put itself together, you know, a billion libraries worth of material for no reason and randomly. And I've heard it said, and you've heard it said, because the alternative is God. The minute you talk about the soul, the minute you talk about anything that isn't material, it must be eternal. It must be absolute. And therefore, has to be justified. Where did it come from? There has to be a creator that's even greater than absolute and eternal. Modernity destroyed the foundations of classical natural right, which is that there is a human nature, there is a human purpose. Therefore, the laws that men create have to be in accordance with this. Reason, freedom, the common good, seem kind of trite, but when you unpack those ideas, you realize that nothing in our system could survive that. Very few people are free. Very few people can think for themselves. Thinking for yourself, I didn't know what that actually would mean. It would mean, I guess, going against the grain. Living a life of reason is almost impossible when the entire system is dedicated to drawing you into some kind of passionate attachment. You need this, you want that, you want to buy this. How any of that can be attached to the neocon agenda in Iraq and Afghanistan is anybody's guess. Of course, Strauss said that the UN is a total delusion. That, in his work on Thucydides, that, you know, one nation cannot attack and occupy another. Same thing for Aristotle, because they believed in nations back then, even if they were Greek. Imperialism is wrong. Because nations exist. Foreigners can't rule as well as natives. We have someone named Chandra Drury who tried to pretend that George Bush reads Strauss, that Strauss rules the White House prior to and after Bill Clinton, claims that because the wise sometimes have to take extreme action to defend themselves. Therefore, that's neocon foreign policy. She actually goes so far as to say that Strauss says that there's no foundation for morality in Strauss's work. Not only is that incorrect, but the entire purpose of Strauss's career was to reject that idea. And they're not, this isn't a matter of opinion. And that he's a nihilist. Strauss's entire career was based on rebuilding absolute foundations for civic life. Claims that he's a historicist. And I've just explained that he's written many things attacking that idea as relativistic. She even claims that Socrates is not Plato's mouthpiece. She even tries to mention, for some reason, even though Strauss never dealt with it, she talks about the Grand Inquisitor, because it makes her sound intelligent. And she, because she's never actually read that little bit of Dostoevsky, she claims that Christ is speaking in it. That Christ is advocating freedom from the Mosaic Law. Christ doesn't say a word in that part of the Brothers Karamazov. And she says that Straussians are philosophically illiterate and can't engage in philosophical discussion. If that isn't an example of projection, then I don't know what is. And of course, in her works on Strauss, there are very few, if any, quotes on him. She uses secondary sources and innuendo and everything else. I wanted to get more into her errors, but it shows you what the Academy is putting out today. Again, if things like gender and ideology and loyalty to the New World Order, if that's really the only reason you're hired and promoted, then why know anything? Why do all the work that's required to become a scholar if that's all you really need? And we're starting to see this happening more and more. Where people are coming out of academic institutions with PhDs who can't think critically, who don't know what methodology is. That this woman is claiming that Strauss believed in things that he didn't just disagree with here and there, but he dedicated his whole career in fighting. There's no way she could have read any of this. But fewer and fewer people in America, I think, are able to read difficult works. And that being the case, Johnson's Law is always evident, because if there are fewer people who don't read Plato and don't understand, you could say anything. But the notion that the neocon foreign policy, in the last couple of decades has anything to do with Leo Strauss is ludicrous. He doesn't mention foreign policy at all, and the few little things he does is vehemently opposed to it. And you have people trying to pretend that they know something, talking about, Straussians and Wolfowitz and all this stuff. These guys never read Strauss. I don't care if these guys have advanced degrees, or if even Bill Kristol took a class with Strauss. He didn't understand a damn thing. And nothing he says suggests otherwise. That's not what the Ivy Leagues are for. So now we're at a position where not only are the academics our enemies, that the only reason that academia as a whole exists is as a pillar of the New World Order, the pillar of liberalism. Not only that, but they don't even do that well. Because that's what they are, they have no incentive to actually do the scholarly work. And this garbage. She's written more than one book on this man and never quotes him. And no one notices. And it's been through peer review and gets good reviews. Now there's a book called Straussophobia where she's been refuted and mocked the same way I am. But that guy is now in some trouble. And he says the same thing I am. He says that this woman has never... How is it these on academic presses? How is this woman an academic at all? Writing about a man that she clearly has never read or understood. Is she simply being told what to do? Or the grant money? It's just, do this, have your grad students throw something together. But some of our people, of course, we're all against the neocons too, drop Leo Strauss's name as if he has anything to do with any of these people. He didn't get Rockefeller grants early on in his career, but he never supported their overarching agenda. In fact, he was vehemently opposed to it. He was a Zionist, that's true. He believes that Athens and Jerusalem are two different things, that's true. That reason and revelation are two different forms of knowledge, that's true. I agree with all, disagree with all that. But these abstract points about the need for absolutes and how modernity has ridiculously rejected that idea. That's the purpose of his whole career. And now you have a woman here who says that none of it is true, and he just backs the neocons, or backed the neocon. He died in the 70s. And, well, no one's going to read Strauss anyway, so I can say whatever I want. It's not just a matter of bad argumentation. It's that she just doesn't know the guy. It's not just a matter of opinion. We could debate on whether he said X, Y, and Z. No, he has entire books rejecting things that this woman claims he supports. Now, claiming that he loved Machiavelli's idea, and yet his entire career was based on the idea that Machiavelli is the severance of classical and modern, classical natural, destruction of classical natural right. And therefore the locus of evil in his mind. In more than one book, he says it. I mean, she's not that good looking. But that's what this woman is. That's who is being promoted in academia. And I'm sitting here. Can't get a job in this academy because it's being filled with women like this who have no idea what they're doing. It's not just that they're wrong. I mean, a lot of things she says about the neocons is true, just for all the wrong reasons. But this kind of crap passes peer review. And people who know that she's not telling the truth shows you the absolutely wicked level of corruption in academia. And even more than that, she projects all of these traits onto her enemies. The exact same things that I'm saying about her, she says about everybody else. And yet she's demonstrated she's not read any of this stuff. And she doesn't even have a cursory understanding of this stuff. It's not a matter of opinion. She's never read it. She has no fluency in philosophical concepts and doesn't even try. But she'll spout out a few slogans now and again. It's all just polemical points, and I'm a woman, and I'm a university professor. Well, I hope she doesn't shoot up the university. I think she's at Calgary, the way Amy Bishop did in Alabama. But like Amy Bishop is the absolute icon of academic corruption, this woman really tells us a lot about where scholarship is. Scholarship is all being done outside of the universities. Universities are not just activists and leftists and communist states. The university is an ideal communist state, the way that it's run, with no rights for white males whatsoever, right-wingers at any level. Not only that, but because their rule is so absolute, they don't really have to know anything. They just have to spout the slogans. Well, if you want to give these people the finger, please send me money. Every dollar you donate to me is an intellectual Molotov cocktail that you throw in the faculty lounge at every university in America. Please help me, my friends. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson and Radio Arianet.com.